Buddhist Summer School, Wednesday, 20th August, 1986. The Yoga Tattva Upanishad, in two verses, states that of the 10 virtuous practices, moderate eating is the most important. And of the 10 religious observances, harmlessness is the most important. Sri Krishna says in the Gita, in the 17th discourse, the foods that augment vitality, energy, vigor, health, joy and cheerfulness, bland, substantial and agreeable are dear to the pure. The Buddha first disciplines the novice in moral habit, next in guarding the doors of his senses, and next he says, come, monk, be moderate in eating. Take food, reflecting carefully, it is not for fun or indulgence, or personal charm or beautification, but taking just enough for maintaining this body and keeping it going. It is for furthering the Brahma faring with the thought, thus will I crush out an old feeling and not allow a new feeling to arise, and then there will be for me subsistence and blamelessness and abiding in comfort. Comes in the second volume of the Majjhima. I beg your pardon, third volume. Food is the most important factor where bodily life is concerned. It is essential for self-preservation. Good health depends mainly on right food and the right mode of consuming it. In the Brahmayu Sutta, which we dealt with yesterday, Uttara tells Brahmayu, the revered Gautama receives neither too little nor too much rice. He eats the proper proportion of curry with rice, one part of curry to three parts of rice. He chews his food very thoroughly, then swallows every bit of it before taking the next mouthful. I have practiced this myself, so I know how beneficial it is to health. He eats his food experiencing its flavor, but not experiencing greed for the flavor. The last point is very important. Greed and the consequent subservience to flavor make a man eat so many things which produce ill results. Uttara continues to say, when he has eaten, he sits silent for a while and then gives thanks. He does not decry that meal nor hope for another meal, but he delights, rouses, inspires and gladdens that assembly with a talk on Dhamma. Then, rising from his seat, he departs. There is also another point in connection with his eating. He eats in silence. This was started by Zarathustra a millennium before the time of the Buddha, that eating food, especially together, the family or a communal meal, they had 6 communal feasts throughout the year. They should eat in silence, well aware of the relationship of themselves with the food. It is an act of communion. If I am not mistaken, the very first greed arises from suckling mother's breasts. I well remember to this day the pleasure of suckling my mother's breasts. The smell and taste of the milk, it's curious, I have a perfect memory of it, and the sound of the suckling. Mother used to tell me I was a greedy little gutsy. And when I was removed from the nipple, there was a full orchestra of frustrated greed, fortissimo, the first violence and hate. Those were, of course, my earliest public lectures. Loud and clear, wordless and senseless, but quite understandable. No recordings are available. Our psychical life starts with frustrated greed and violence on the unpleasant side, and the experience of parental loving care on the pleasant side. We have the essence of good advice in the scriptures of the world, as in the quotations given earlier, on the question of food, from the scientific as well as the spiritual point of view. He who studies it carefully and abides by what he discovers about the proper food that best suits his constitution will be a wise religia. Food affects all aspects of our existential being, physical, psychological, cultural, and spiritual. As for food, so also for drink, for bodily exercise, and for sleep. You must discover by sensible experimentation what suits you best, remembering that you are unique. Let intelligent, sensible, and practicable austerity be a guiding principle. Don't allow any austerity to be imposed upon you, but see that it is practicable for you. Experiment with and follow the Buddha's guiding principle where bodily nourishment is concerned. He, of course, recommended one meal in the middle of the day. Study also the teaching where the purification of the psyche and the nourishment of mind is concerned. This is where meditation comes in. Study with a completely open mind. That is, challenge every teaching, but challenge it in the spirit of pure inquiry and not merely to agree or disagree. Thereby, you will release yourself from the chains of the conditioning of the brain since your birth. Also, you will empty your psyche of all its dark clutter, which hinders the transcendent light of pure mind from suffusing your whole being. And through you, irradiating all the world with Mahakaruna and Mahaprajna. You, the existential mortal, will thus be the transmitter or even a source of light, life and love unto all creation. But live in this wise, utterly free of the slightest trace of any desire or ambition to be a world savior or world teacher or world enlightener. If only politically minded people could take that to heart, we might be better off. When we use the words I, you, he, she, it, we are rarely aware that they represent an existential being or object. Each and every existential being is a mortal being, subject to dukkha, to delusion, to death. He is still subhuman. As I explained the other day, not used pejoratively, but just to indicate that humanity has not yet evolved to its full potential. But when he has completely purified himself, when he is the embodied Sila, Samadhi, Panya, he is at last the full-fledged human. The real meaning of the word human is blissful creator. And that is the way people have described God. The God idea, the God conception, is an expression of our own aspiration, whether conscious or subconscious, towards our own supreme fulfillment. But that is the real meaning of the word human. If you like, later on I'll explain why I give that meaning. When he has realized that, he is the non-existential being. The Sato Sattasa comes in Majjhima 140. The same page where the Buddha says, formerly as now, I teach only one thing. I preach only one thing. Sorrow and the deliverance from sorrow. It comes on that page. Although still wearing the mortal existential body. The Sato Sattasa is the immortal essence, not as a separate bit of the essence, but the whole of the immortal essence. The total immeasurable, the infinite eternal. You know, this is one of the extremely difficult things to realize. But thanks to science, which has discovered what a hologram means, we can begin to understand with our own minds what that means. I think the other day I said that the whole of transcendence, the whole of infinity and all of eternity is embodied in each and every single particular, from an atom or a virus to the total universe or the perfected Holy One. Now one's brain boggles at it. It's impossible to visualize it. But you will someday experience it if you understand how to meditate rightly. And this is an extremely difficult question. This one infinite eternal, by manifesting, appears in countless existential forms. Manifesting as the human species, it wears an incalculable number of suits, all the human beings that have lived, are living, and will live from the beginning of time. Each suit is made up of Rupa, Vedana, Sanya, Sankhara, and Vijnana, the Buddhist analysis. The Buddha showed quite clearly that all these components are mortal. The existential being, the manifested person, dies completely. Sato Satasa never dies. It cannot die, for it was never born. Compare that statement in the New Testament. Before Abraham was, before Abraham was the I Am. That's my way of looking at it. There is no the in the actual English translation. And people, it is rather confusing. If you read it straight off, it's before Abraham was I Am. One doesn't quite appreciate that. What Jesus is really referring to is just this. And this is where studying the Kabbalah is a great help. Before Abraham was the I Am, the one and only I Am. You see, if you take that in conjunction with Exodus chapter 3, verse 14, where the Lord God speaks out of the burning bush and tells Moses when he inquires, if the Israelites ask me, who has sent me, say unto them, Ehiye, Asher, Ehiye. I, Moses, am that I Am, the Supreme Being. When existentiality is transcended, not destroyed, Sato Satasa is simply the absolute infinite eternal, that is, the deathless, the immortal. But please do not think of it as a separate, identifiable entity. Every entity is mortal. The perfect realization of the holy life, the Brahmacharya, releases Tathagata, the immeasurable, the trackless. I've forgotten the exact reference, but somewhere in the commentaries on the Theravada text, the Atta is identified with the Tathagata. The Atta, meaning the Atma. There is a discourse named the Ganaka Moggallana Sutta, Majjhima 3:1-7. The Brahman Ganaka Moggallana must not be mistaken for Moggallana, the close companion of Sariputta, or with another Moggallana called Gopaka Moggallana. This one was Ganaka, not Gopaka. When the Lord was staying near Savatthi in the palace of Migara's mother in the eastern monastery, this Brahman approached the Lord and sat down at a respectful distance after exchanging greetings and conversing in a friendly and courteous way. It's very interesting to notice this emphasis on courtesy and considerateness and being respectful and so on. He said, "Good Gotama, just as there was a gradual training and a gradual practice for those who built the palace, for building this palace, we Brahmins also have a gradual training and practice. Is it not possible, good Gotama, to lay down a similar gradual training, doing and practice in your Dhamma and discipline?" The Buddha answers, "Yes, it is possible." And then he gives a succinct account of the discipline for those monks who are learners, who, perfection being not yet attained, dwell longing for the incomparable security from the bonds. Then the Brahman asks, do all the monks, thus instructed and exhorted, attain the unchanging goal, Nibbana, or do some not attain it? Gautama answers, some do, some do not. The Brahman wants to know how that comes about, since Nibbana and the way to it exist, and Gautama exists as advisor. Then Gautama asks him if he knows the way to Rajagaha, and the Brahman says that he does. Now then, says Gautama, if a man comes to you inquiring the way to Rajagaha, and you gave him exact instructions, but he takes a wrong turning and goes in the opposite direction. Then a second man comes wanting to go to Rajagaha, and you gave him the same instructions, which he follows exactly and gets to Rajagaha safely. What is the cause? What is the reason, asks Gautama, that since Rajagaha and the way to it exist, and you exist as advisor, one man misses getting to Rajagaha while the other gets there? The Brahman says, what can I, good Gautama, do in this matter? As sure of the way am I. And Gautama says, even so, Brahman, Nibbana does exist, the way to Nibbana exists, and I exist as advisor. But while some of my disciples, on being exhorted and instructed thus by me, attain the unchanging goal, Nibbana, some do not attain it. What can I do in this matter? As sure of the way, Brahman, is a Tathagata. The Brahman, Ganaka Moggallana, responds with a long statement, of which the first part portrays in detail the shortcomings of the unworthy person who has gone forth from home into homelessness, and the second part of the worthy and diligent monk who realizes Nibbana. Then he sings praise to the Buddha. As, good Gautama, black gum is pointed to as chief of root sense, as red sandalwood is pointed to as chief of pith sense, as jasmine is pointed to as chief of flower sense, even so is the exhortation of the good Gautama the highest among the teachings of today. 25 centuries ago, the realization of human fruition was spoken of as the attainment of a goal, a personal achievement. The time is at hand when we must try to present it in a more suitable way. A personal achievement implies an achievement by an existential being who is isolatively and separatively self-consciousness. Vijnana functions analytically in him, in terms of finite and temporal particulars. It splits up the unitary whole into countless bits. The basic duality in consciousness of self and not-self is the root of all conflict, contradiction, and confusion. It is characteristic of the isolatively self-conscious person, the rupa to vijnana complex, which, as the Buddha taught, is the perishable. It is anatta because it has no creative power. Now it's very instructive to look into the Buddha's own words. At Benares in the Deer Park was the occasion for this discourse. The Exalted One thus addressed the band of five brethren. The five were Kundanya, Vappa, Bhadiya, Mahanama and Asaji. Those were the first five. Body, brethren, is not the self. This not the self. If body, brethren, were the self, he uses the word atta, which is the Pali for the Sanskrit atma, then body would not be involved in sickness, and one could say of body, thus let my body be, thus let my body not be. But, brethren, inasmuch as body is not the self, that is why body is involved in sickness. And one cannot say of body, thus let my body be, thus let my body not be. Then he repeats the same thing with respect to feeling, to perception, and so on, to consciousness. All the five constituents, rupa, vedna, sanya, sankhara, vijnana. And then he goes on to say, now what think ye, brethren? Is body permanent or impermanent? Impermanent, Lord. And what is impermanent? Is that weal or woe? Woe, Lord. Then what is impermanent, woeful, unstable by nature? Is it fitting to regard it thus? This is mine, I am this. This is the self of me. You know, this sort of argumentation comes also in one of the great Upanishads, the Maitri Upanishad. Surely not, Lord. So also is it with feeling, perception, the activities and consciousness. Therefore, because every body whatsoever be it past, future or present, be it inward or outward, gross or subtle, low or high, far or near, every body should be thus regarded as it really is, by right insight. This is not mine. This am not I. This is not the self of me. Note carefully the translation. It's a very good translation. This is not the self of me. Na me so atta. Every feeling, and then he goes on repeating that for the feeling, etc., right up to consciousness. So seeing, the well-taught Aryan disciple feels, the Buddha may have used the word disgust, but I would rather think that the implication is he's no longer interested in the body or the feelings, etc., right up to vijnana. So, by being disinterested, he is repelled. He is freed. Knowledge arises that in the freed is the freed thing, so that he knows. Destroyed is jati, translated, of course, as rebirth. Lived is the righteous life. Done is my task. For life in these conditions, there is no hereafter. Now, note carefully, the word, the Pali word is jati, and birth and rebirth are the first translations. But jati is also, it has also another meaning. It is the conditioned state. And you will find in the Digha Nikaya one very interesting long discourse where the king, who is a liberated one, tells his wife, do not worry about all these things because they are all conditioned states. You are in bondage thereby. When you relinquish the conditioned state and are free of it, then you'll be liberated. I forget the name of the discourse. It's in the Digha Nikaya. So, if we translate it this way, destroyed is the return to the conditioned state. And it all happens in the course of one's own lifetime, continuously. All our thought, feeling, speaking, doing is a conditioned state and it is subject to time. And that means that it is subject to beginning and ending, to birth and death. And this really is, and one associates one's self-consciousness, the idea of the self, I am I think, I feel, I do, with that temporal and finite state. And that is the coming to birth of the I, and the passing away in death of the I when that state is over. That is how I interpret it. Take it or leave it. Thus spake the exalted one, and the band of five brethren, he's used the word brethren for bhikkhus, were pleased thereat, and welcomed what was said by the exalted one. Moreover, by this teaching thus uttered, the hearts of the five were freed from the asavas, which they are called cankers. The asavas are cankers, without grasping. I think it is better really to use the literal meaning of the word asava. The first meaning of the word asava is an overflow. If, for example, you strike an axe into a sapling or a tree, it will ooze out, won't it? That is the overflow. Now, if you think of it this way, we are in a state of consciousness. Let us assume that we are in a very deep state of consciousness, almost like nirvana. Now, if that state of consciousness overflows into something which attracts because of our pleasure drive or some kama-sava, bhava-sava, we want to become this and that, this, that and the other, you see, and so forth, then those are the overflows of consciousness into the limited states. I think you will find it easier to understand these things then. And when you're freed from the tendency to overflow as a reaction to external stimuli, then you are, there is no grasping left. You grasp at nothing whatsoever. Now the same argument is used by the Buddha, as put in the Mahavagga. It is his second sermon, you know. The first sermon was the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, the turning of the wheel of the law. The very sound, it is onomatopoeic. Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta goes very nicely, you see. That was the first one. And then the next day, he gives this to the five. speaks about the body not being the self, Vedna not being the self, Sanya, and he goes on in the same way. The same argumentation goes on. And the same conclusion is arrived at. So I won't read it because we mustn't spend too much time on that. Being confined to existentiality, to isolative and separative self-consciousness, we are not conscious of the fact that the one total reality is a unitary whole. And what we, in our limited state, see as countless separate particulars are in fact completely interrelated and interactive with each other. See, constituted as we are and developed only to a partial extent and not having realized our full potential implied in the meaning of the word human, we see things as separate and we fail to be aware of the complete interrelatedness and interaction between ourselves and everything without exception. Take as an analogy our own living psychophysical body, which is a microcosm, the analogue of the macrocosm, the universe. It consists of several hundred million times million cells. For several, use X. X times 10 to the power 14. Now when you go home, count the number of cells you have and you'll find that is true. When the body is perfectly well, we are aware of it only as a one thing. You just say, I. A unitary whole. But we are unaware of the interrelatedness and interactivity of all those X times 10 to the power 14 cells constituting the unitary whole, which is our one single body. Only when there is a pain or a disturbance in the body do we become aware of a something else present, and we are in a state of dukkha, and there is also present a consciousness of otherness, of an other that is out of harmony with the all. Now, we as we are at present are overwhelmingly dominated by the consciousness of otherness. What's your thought process? What's your process of observation and how all the senses function? You will see that you are aware of everything as or something else, this, that and the other. That it is true that our consciousness can only at present see, can only work in terms of otherness. And it can't work in terms of being able to be sensitive to the interrelatedness. It is that interrelatedness which has to grow, which the religious life does. Hence, all our dukkha. But by treading the way, by living the holy life, the psyche is emptied, made void of all its defilements. And since our own body is a psychophysical organism, the material component of the organism also experiences a healing, whole-making influence. What then happens to vijnana? It undergoes a transmutation. Its usual separativeness and isolativeness its usual conceptualizing in a mistaken manner, due largely to its conditioning from birth and also to the influence of the evolutionary process of the brain over hundreds of millions of years, changes and changes, grows and grows, till in culmination it flowers out into pure, holistic consciousness, which the Buddha called Vijnanam Anidasanam Anantam Sabbato Pabam. Consciousness which is characterless, signless, endless, everywhere shining. This is the Buddha's equivalent to the Upanishadic Atma, because that's how the Upanishads describe the Atma too. Holistic consciousness rejects nothing. It is an all-embracing, inclusive consciousness, a powerful energy of pure mind which transforms, transmutes, not destroys or overcome, all evil into the good, because the supreme converting power of Mahakaruna and Mahaprajna are actively present in holistic consciousness, in which there is no such thing as separate self, but only the all-encompassing us. You will be clearly conscious in terms of us, of the whole of humanity. Then the real era of socialism can dawn. The multiplicity is now the unity, and since there is no separate self, all that belongs to the context of separate selfhood, such as striving, competing, attaining, winning, achieving, etc., all this is out and has no place or meaning. So, you as a separate, identifiable entity never enter or attain Nibbana. Remember that Nibbana's true meaning was the extinction of greed, hate and delusion. I say was because instead of extinction, I today would say transmutation. Do you know that the founders of some of the great religions have ascribed the creation of evil as well as the good to the Supreme Being? You study the Gathas of Zarathustra. In Deuteronomy chapter 30, verses 15 and 22, in Isaiah, no, I'm sorry, it's 15 and 19. I've got the wrong number there. In Isaiah chapter 45, verse 7, the Lord God says clearly, I create the light and goodness. I create evil. I, the Lord, do all these things. It's very interesting. Some of those old people knew what they were talking about. And Sri Krishna in the Gita 10:36 says, amongst other things, I am the gambling of the cheat, and the splendor of splendid things am I. It's absolutely extraordinary. Ours is the responsibility of purification and of releasing perfection, for we humans are the heralds of eternity. For who else on earth but we can sing the song of eternity through all of ever-dying time? Who else on earth but we can unveil the face of beauty of the infinite as we dance through all the measureless expanses of space? It is to this holistic consciousness, this truth and beauty, love and wisdom of transcendence itself, towards which the whole human race is moving very, very slowly, but moving. You may ask, when will man arrive there? Never in time, but certainly here now, in the immediacy of the living moment. How will he arrive there? By living the religious life, which is no other than the whole of the secular life lived virtuously.